Hi, everyone. This is CBA, and I'm from the class of 84, and I am with Pam Allen, also from the class of 84, and the author of What to Read When. I thought we would start first by talking a little bit about Amherst and our connection to the school. Pam,
yes.
I know you have a lot to share about all your different Amherst connections.
Oh, well, you know, Phoebe, I love Amherst so much, and somebody recently asked me, because our daughter Katie is now a sophomore there, when was the first time I fell in love with the college, and I think I was so young, because my father also went there, as you know, and my two uncles, and I think I grew up already loving it so much, and whenever we visit Katie, we're so feel so lucky to be able to be with her up there, because it, I think for both Jim and I, my husband Jim Allen, who also went to Amherst, it feels a lot like home to us. And I wonder, do you feel that way when you go back? Or
well, definitely. And I think you and I and Jim, we had sort of a very big year very recently, and it was amazing to be back with my classmates.
Yes.
And other schoolmates, and
yes.
It's a very, very special place.
I feel that way, too, and I think that it's one of the things that seems to sustain us over the years. I know for me with you, Phoebe, and other special friends from Amherst, it's, there's a such a connection there that feels, it really transcends time.
And, you know, just to segue to what we are in the middle of this afternoon, I think that it's so wonderful to have this opportunity to talk about books sort of ensconced in the Amherst community. Let's start with the book. I mean, what is amazing to me is, if I've counted correctly, this is really your seventh book. Is that right? Or
yes.
Seventh published book?
Yeah, it is. I was just pausing because I feel like I have a few more in the works right now, but this is my seventh published book, and I definitely feeling like the words are pouring out. I've had so many years to have the privilege of being in classrooms alongside children and raising our own daughters and thinking a lot about literature and literacy for so long that I feel like the last few years have been a lot about just trying to put some of those ideas down and get them out, so as to share some of my observations of what I've noticed about childhood and about the power of words.
So all along, over the years, were you keeping notes about questions that came up all the time, things friends and other teachers and parents would ask you? Is that partially how the idea for What to Read When came about?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, living in a community where we live in the town of Hastings, which actually reminds me a lot of Amherst in its community feeling and the way people are together here. And I think there have been so many times over the years where parents and teachers have asked, and then of course, as my organization Lit Life has grown across the country, I noticed there were questions that parents especially, but also teachers have about children's development as readers and also just the literature that really resonates with children particularly. And I have kept pretty good notes about a lot of that, but at the same time, I started to realize there was a real pattern. And you know, parents and teachers, you know, all of us together were kind of hungry for some really concrete ways that we can make sure that we are raising our children with that kind of joy and spirit for literacy and for literature. So I would say there are definitely some themes to that, you know, parents wanting and teachers wanting books that will help children through wonderful times and hard times and help children learn how to read and help children learn how to connect to other people and to reach out beyond themselves. And I started to think, wow, children's literature is not just about learning to read. It's really, and you know this, Phoebe, for the important work that you do as editor at HarperCollins, I think it's about values, too. I mean, I really think that it's a children's literature is an incredible way to talk to children about some of the things that on a day-to-day basis are not so easy to talk about. And some of these children's book authors that you've been so brilliant at bringing to all of us have actually, I think, really changed the landscape of parenting and teaching.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about as I was reading the book was it's not just for children who are reading. It really reminded me of favorites that I go back to even now as an adult. It is definitely true that I come out of a professional experience of working with children's books for a long time, so I am familiar with a lot of the books, a lot of the reference books that are out there, and what I was really struck by is how you found a way to make your book unique. There's definitely, I think a lot of us have heard about Jim Chalice, who I think was a pioneer in encouraging caregivers to read aloud to very, very young children and to keep reading. But what I noticed about your book is what you made that was different. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that. And you know, areas where you deliberately tried to encourage caregivers to think about reading in a slightly different way.
Well, I think from my observation in terms of the power of the read aloud, and I completely agree with you that Jim Chalice, for me, was a huge mentor, inspiration. That book, The Read Aloud Handbook, was, I think, foundational book in my professional life.
Really the first of its kind.
Yeah, first of its kind and just tremendous. And I was absolutely thrilled and honored that he blessed my book with such kind words. And I've had the, you know, good fortune of feeling that he's behind me in this, too, this message of reading aloud to children. I mean, I guess for me also just being in the classroom, working with teachers, the work I do as a teacher educator in particular, really thinking about the role the read aloud can play in terms of cultivating conversation and scaffolding a child's understanding of the world, that it is really, I mean, it's like pouring language into a child's mind and heart. But beyond that, I think it's also a transaction. I've never gotten tired of some of the classics because when I read them with children, whether they're my own children or my relatives' children or the boys that I work with at Children's Village who are in foster care or children in Kenya or children anywhere in the world, I feel like I'm always learning something new. If the writing is good and the writing is strong, that child is going to remark on something in that story that I will never have noticed. And it's just a constant delight and surprise to me, and I realize to myself this could be a really important observation in a way that maybe we don't talk about it nearly enough, but that the child's perspective or the child's understanding is the children's book is a way for the child to name some of that experience that he or she is having and to let us in on that world, which is so mysterious, that world of childhood. And I think children's literature really opens those doors if we create the kinds of environments in which we are reading aloud, which is what Jim Chalice was championing and really was the first one to say, you know, this is more important than anything, and I stand by that. And then beyond that, to say, what are the ways that we can encircle the child in safety and also in structures around the read aloud that provide opportunities for the child to talk about that book and really be with you in a conversation so that reading, because reading truly is not solitary, it is a community act in the best of, you know, all circumstances. And I think that's why sometimes children, you know, parents say, well, gosh, you know, my child seemed to love to read, and then as soon as he could read on his own, he doesn't want to read anymore. And I said, you know, it's a little lonely, you know, and so bring your child back to the couch with you because reading doesn't have to be so lonely.
Exactly. Well, I also feel that you offered very pragmatic advice. I think that so often parents, especially want the kids to read up. So I have to applaud you for saying, you know what, not only read on level, but it is okay to share books that were a little bit easier, and it is also okay to introduce books that are a little challenging. I think that is one of the most common misconceptions,
yes.
Wanting constantly, oh, that's too easy,
yes.
and being dismissive of terrific books that actually everyone can benefit from. I wonder if you would want to, you know, pursue that a little bit more, because that's something I think,
yes,
so few people understand.
I think it's so important. I agree, and I think, you know, teachers do it too, and it's all out of the best of, you know, intentions. I mean, people want kids to grow and progress as readers, and two things I say. One is that rereading is so important for the development of that child's reading life. The act of rereading, the child is becoming more comfortable with the text, but also every time the child goes back, the child is going deeper and looking at something different. So first, she might be looking at the words. Next, she might be looking at the pictures. But third, she might be really going deeper underneath the story. And so the act of rereading is important, but also, like you said, reading not at your level, but reading those, what we, you know, we might say, oh, that book is too easy for you. But there's something in that book that's helping that child build stamina by going back to it. It's helping that child understand something that she's grappling with. You know, I remember my daughter reading Bedtime for Francis. You know, she wanted to read that over and over and over. And, you know, I think bedtime was not so easy for her. And as a matter of fact, it's not so easy for me. So I really relate to that. I think Francis, you know, with her big eyes looking at her dad in the middle of the night, wondering about the swaying curtain, wondering if it's, you know, something dangerous, that we can all relate to. But for the child who's experiencing that, it's such an important process to go back and to reread and to reread and to reread and to use the book as a way to explore the big themes, but also just to get more comfortable as a reader. The child who's rereading what we call, quote, the easier books is also building stamina. So the child who could read independently just for a short period of time, by rereading Magic Treehouse 1,000 times over, becomes faster and stronger, reading stronger. These are all just as important things as the numbers of titles we read. And I do think that the best books are the books that are not, they're not necessarily, you know, not all children's literature is what we consider to be, quote, great or classic. Some of it is really just the way we read, too. It's that book that you just want to sit down on the couch and just curl up, put your feet up, take a break, and use reading as a way to really rest your mind.
Well, I think you also point out that it's not just reading books, that if you want to read magazines or if you want to read an ad, or you also mentioned obituaries,
yes,
and how that was something I think your dad sort of turned you on to. So it's not just about a traditional book.
Yeah, and I think that's actually, it's really interesting, especially with boys and girls, because I've asked, you know, men in my life, friends and relatives, and, you know, what are their memories as readers as kids, and inevitably they'll say to me, oh, I didn't read much as a kid. And then 5 seconds later they'll say, well, I read, you know, sports books, and I read magazines, and I read, but they don't name themselves as readers, because, and then I'll say, well, what do you mean? You said you read this and you read that. Oh, that's not really reading.
Right.
And I think that, you know, that doesn't do us any good, because the truth of the matter is, as adults, most of what we probably read on a regular course of the day, wouldn't, you know, is nonfiction, you know, is magazines and the internet and these types of things. So this is important reading, but for some reason, as teachers and parents, we have this idea that, you know, if it doesn't have a medal on it, it's not as valuable. And so, what do you think about that? I mean,
Something we talk about all the time, you know, what kids want to read, what they should be reading, the subject of what boys will read,
mm-hmm,
is something we think about a lot, because there are a lot of studies, and they do show that usually girls will continue reading after they are, you know, sort of 11, 12, and into teen years, and there always does seem to be some sort of drop-off for boys, and especially for a publishing company, we do think about these things, and we try to figure out, you know, what do boys want to read, because it definitely, we can just tell by which books we're selling for kids at a particular age. Generally speaking, when the kids are picture book readers, it's pretty much even. And then starting with what we call the tween years, 8 to 12, all of a sudden, you know, we start talking about boy books and girl books, and you hate to be sexist, but you definitely see sort of patterns.
I agree. And I have to say that I've been really out there in schools in particular talking to teachers about being very conscious of what's in their classroom library, making sure that, you know, especially as a profession that's composed so predominantly of women, just to really be conscious of how we're valuing what kids are reading so that boys don't drop off in the tween because they feel outside the experience. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It might be less about even that they don't want to read, and more that it's been sort of told to them that they're not as valid as readers because they're not gravitating to the same kind of...
Or they want to read something else. I mean, would you say to an educator, you know, would you encourage him or her to find other... If a boy really just doesn't want to read a book, would you say just let him read a magazine, or how do you work around that?
Well, what I say to teachers is that in the classroom, I mean, I really want them to offer a balanced diet, you know, so I want them to expose their kids, boys and girls, so that, in other words, this is also about equity for girls, too, that I want to expose, just like my dad exposed me to the sports pages at a time, you know, when there wasn't even Title IX yet, you know, so I want my girls in the classroom to be as equally exposed to genre in a very equitable way, sports magazines, science magazines, things that are historically more about boys, but girls may enjoy just as much. But I also do want them to have a balanced diet, so I'll say to teachers, you know, in a perfect world, I'd have each child would have their own, you know, book bag with their independent reading books in it, and it would be a combination of books at your level, books that might be your comfortable reread, a book that is somewhat of a classic that you'd like for your student to have read this year, and perhaps a couple of magazines or a poetry collection, or, you know, something that's not necessarily a narrative read, but that is enjoyable and pleasurable for that child. So there's a variety, just like when we think about what we eat. We love different things, but we love them the most because there's a variety in them. And I think it's okay as teachers and parents, too, to say, gee, it looks like you love to read these magazines, so I'm going to make sure I have those for you. But I'd also like for you to commit to reading, you know, one of these great books that I know, you know, by the end of fifth grade, I was just so happy I read it. I think kids see that as being fair. I think the problem is when we have a very narrow idea of what's okay, and then that makes some kids feel really outside of that.
Or like the classics. Where are you on the classics?
Oh.
Is it bad if you haven't read, you know, Kidnapped when you're 10?
Oh. Boy, that's a big question.
All right, that was not on
the list. Oh, that was not on the list. All right, I'll just say quickly, and you tell me too, because I want to know what you think. I would say some of what we're calling classics are not withstanding the test of time, and they need to be revisited. Are they really essential reading? And two, I would say there are books that appear in our culture a lot. You know, they're like reference points, and people make reference to them. And I think my daughters would say they're glad that they have read some of those books so that they can kind of understand the culture in a certain way. But for a child or even a young adult, when I work with the boys at Children's Village who are really struggling through school, not to anything of their own fault, but just a very tough and rough personal lives that have brought them through the foster care system, for them to have to read in 10th grade a book that they cannot read. It's not at their level. I'd much rather say than read. If you feel that they must have The Great Gatsby under their belt, then read it aloud to them.
Or what do you think of graphic novels that are based on the classic?
Yeah, I think those are, happy about those. I mean, I am, because I feel like when I think about the boys at Children's Village, it brings them into the culture. It doesn't leave them out, because literature does represent something about belonging. And I think then for them, and for others too, for lots of kids, I mean, the boys are my touch point, because I always am asking them, how does that feel? And, you know, where do you feel strong as a reader, and where do you feel like you're not really making the connection? And they're very grateful for those graphic novels.
Yeah. So that's a good thing, and it's okay.
What do you think? Do you agree?
Yeah, you know, listen, as long as you're reading something, it's okay with
that's
me.
That's a, yeah.
You know, you had raised another point in the book about don't worry so much about the number of books you've read and focus on how much time you read in a given day, which I thought was another point that sometimes gets obscured. I mean, I know there are so many different contests run in class and in schools and at home about, if you read X number of books, by Y time, you will get such and thus, or, you know, and so it's just about the number of books read, maybe not focusing as much on what you get from reading 20 minutes a day, if you can.
Yeah, you know, it always reminds me of this. I was in a classroom one day, and the teacher took me aside and said, see, you know, there's Joey over there, and I'm so worried about him, because while the other kids have read a million books, you know, in the last month and a half, look at him. And we looked at him, and he was like, his head was like 2 inches away from, a DK eyewitness book, or just a kind of a reference book on the planets. And he was really, his head was like really, and I went over and I sat beside him, and I said, Joey, you know, tell me, what are you reading? And he looked up with his eyes like glazed over, and he said, I could just read about Mars all day long. And I thought, oh my gosh, what a kid. He's totally engaged, but the teacher from a distance is worried, because it's so, the idea of like acquisitional reading, you know, it's like, we've got to get through, we have 20 left, we've got to get through it. And I just really think that there he is, you know, the reader we all want in our classroom. He's so deep in the book, he's so deep in the thought. Oh, my word.
So think of that sort of a larger picture, which I think sometimes can be hard for people. So you have a very, very busy schedule. But when did you find the time to write the book?
Oh, well, I don't sleep that much. I'll tell you that. My family worries about me, because I seem not to need that much sleep, but I feel, knock on wood, I generally feel pretty good. I think also this book was really just a joy to write, because I love, you know, my two favorite things are children and books. And it was a book for, you know, for families, for caregivers, for teachers. And I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunities I've had to be so close to children in ways that I could listen in. And it just didn't feel, it felt like a pleasure. Like if I could have written it all day long, every day, I would have done that. And, you know, but I, of course, did have to go to work and did have to do my job, but I just could not wait to get home and just to keep talking in my mind to the audience that I was thinking about. I just couldn't wait. I every day I would be thinking, it made me so happy.
Well, what made me so happy was being reminded of books I have loved over the years. And then I wondered, how did you narrow down your choices? So two books that came to mind immediately were Blueberries for Sal and Mountains of Tibet, which I was so happy to see,
yes,
you know, in a book, somebody else's book, because that book I feel is, I think one of the most important books I've read. So was it hard to narrow down these choices?
Oh, it was terrible. It was excruciating. And the whole way through, I thought, you know, I was cringing, because I said to myself, you know, and I thought about, you know, everybody that I admire, you and other of my colleagues and friends, and I thought, nobody's going to think this book is complete because everybody's going to be missing one of their favorites in there. And because there's no way, you know, in the pages that we have. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of had to get tough with myself. And I just said, you know, I'm just going to, the books that are, you know, luminously around me, knowing that I'm going to forget some, that there are going to be some that people don't agree should be there or not be there. And I, luckily, I think, because book lovers know how hard making a list is, I think people have been so much more understanding than I thought they would be about it. You know, just, yes, we understand this is a selective list. I knew there were some that had to be, and I'm so glad you appreciate the Berries for Sale and Mountains of Tibet, because I so agree. I think those are two great books, and I love that I could put them both between the pages of this book.
Yeah, I mean, not that I have anything against Make Way for Ducklings, but I feel that sometimes Blueberries for Sale doesn't get the right attention, so
yeah.
I was very gratified by that. One of the things I noticed about What to Read When is that it really is very, very personal in the way that you share your connection to the printed word, whether it's a book or a poem, newspaper article. A lot of these guides are a little bit clinical in the way they certainly share recommendations, but you don't hear quite so much about your own reading experience as an author, your family, what you see in the classroom, what you have experienced, and what I really relished is it's just a great book about the love of reading a particular genre. So
well,
I applaud
thank you, Phoebe.
I
thank
applaud you for that.
Thank you so much. Well, I've had really a very wonderful experience talking to people across the country about children's books and about teaching and about parenting. And what I notice is that, you know, years later, if I run into somebody in the supermarket or, you know, at another conference, what has always struck me is that people will, first, they don't say, oh, I remember you taught me, you know, that reading strategy. They'll say, I remember you talked about that soup story and your grandma, you know, and I think that's it, you know, story is really what matters, and it's what brings us together, and it's why the putting of out in the world of children's books, I think, is such important work, because it's basically saying, you know, story does matter, and it matters from the very youngest age, and I hoped I conveyed that. I'm very honored that you would note that, because I feel like that, for me, is the whole of it, is that we do as human, you know, the work of raising children is such a human work, and it's a complex work, and sometimes, you know, as a parent or as a teacher or as a grandparent, you just don't have that many people you can turn to and say, are we doing all right? And I think stories help us, they sustain us, they make sense of the world, they make sense of ourselves, and so I wanted to convey that, because I noticed that list books, there's so many of those out there, and I always think, what is missing? And for me, I wanted to convey that, you know, the whole thing really at the end is it is all about love, you know, love for words and love for children. And if you're not someone who loves to read, I say to parents, you know, sometimes parents will come up to me after a conference or a workshop or a PTA meeting and say, you know, just between you and me, I don't like to read myself, but I want my child to grow up and love to read. What am I going to do? And I wanted this book to be for them, too.
Well, and also thinking about a typical Amherst grad parent, I think he or she also struggles. I mean, they want their kids to read, but you go into a store or a library and there is so much to choose from, and you want to try to choose correctly, and it's hard. One of the categories that's in the book, it seems like you've made a distinction of, you know, what might be developmentally appropriate from sort of an emotional perspective for an 8-year-old mm-hmm. versus a 9-year-old versus a 10-year-old. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that is not something I have seen elsewhere. And what publishing people do, we lump the kids. Picture book readers, ages 3 to 7, tween, 8 to 12, teen, everything above that. And that's a very large age gap. And
yes,
I think
so
you tried
much.
To address that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, really, again, lessons from the classroom. I said, you know, teachers will say to us, they do that in educational publishing, too. Teachers receive technical information, and it will say grades K through 2. And the kindergarten teacher will say to me, my kindergartner is nothing like a second grader. You know, a kindergartner has just been on the earth for 5 years and is just learning how to, you know, Velcro a sneaker, you know, or a zipper a coat, whereas a second grader, you know, has lost 10 teeth and is learning how to be a soccer goalie, you know. So I think that the differences, some are profound and some are very subtle, and I really practice through that a lot with thinking in classrooms about what lessons are just right for children at what age, and not that all children, you know, at kindergarten are the same, because by no means are they, and you know, each child is like a snowflake, really. But I think that as far as that goes, there are some very predictable developmental patterns, and I say, you know, to myself that I want to make sure that we, as adults, we do really honor those, because that, for example, you know, third graders, I notice 8-year-olds, for example, are much more conscious of the outside world. You know, they're just starting to peek out. They're just starting to think of themselves in the bigger picture as living creatures who, you know, thinking about death and thinking about friendship and thinking about bigger. Not to say the younger child doesn't, because they do think about all those things, but in a certain way I notice, you know, 8 is a big turning point, and then something else starts to happen at 9, and something else. You know, there's that great poem I quote in the book, the Billy Collins poem on turning 10, and wow, what an incredible poem that is. But I think one could be written. I've had kids in classrooms write, you know, on turning 8, on turning 7, on turning 6, and there's something different to be said at each age.
Yeah, and that's something I think that doesn't often get stressed, so good
for
you.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about Anne of Green Gables, which I confessed I read year after year.
Me
after
too,
year,
baby.
4 years. So it was very reassuring to find out I was not alone. But I loved the story about Jim.
Yeah.
And his response to Anne of Green Gables.
Well, you know, that's the thing about marriage. It's like you've got to go with each other down some roads. That was one big one because, you know, he's very gracious and I think has been an extraordinary father to two beautiful girls and wonderful girls. And he went with us down, has gone with us down many, many paths, but this might have been the ultimate. You know, we were traveling and listening to Anne of Green Gables on tape and just crossed over the bridge onto Prince Edward Island, where Lucy Maud Montgomery, who wrote those books, grew up and told the story of Anne of Green Gables. And to this day, if you're an Anne fan, you should definitely go, because the whole island is like a tribute to Anne of Green Gables. It's amazing. And we were taking this pilgrimage because our girls just love these books, and we were listening to it again on tape. And the three of us, I had read it to the girls, but Jim had never heard it. And we were just crossing the bridge to get onto the island, and the book came to an end. And for those of you listening, Phoebe and I won't tell you what happens at the end of that first book, but suffice it to say, it's kind of emotional. And I turned to say something to Jim, because I've heard, you know, I just like you, Phoebe, I've read that book a million times. And I turned, and there he was, just sobbing, sobbing, sobbing. And I said, now that is why I married that man.
Exactly. And then that's why, you know what, I mean, have you been able to persuade any of the boys at Children's Village to give the Anne of Green Gables a chance? Or?
I think if the cover was different, I think covers definitely matter. I long for the day when maybe, you know, there's not the red-haired girl on the cover. I think that's tough, you know. Mm-hmm. I think the boys want to see, is this going to be about someone like me? And so that's tough. But you know, I'll get
think
there.
Of what all the boys have missed over the years. Well, so the kids really do judge a book by its cover.
Totally. You
kind
know
of what we thought all along. Yeah. All right. Well, that would be our job. So tell us about Wayne, who is a student of yours, and how he was the inspiration for your pointers that you generously share.
Yeah, he, some students, some children, you know, they really stay in your very essence, and Wayne was one of those students for me. He was an older boy, entering teens, about 13 years old. He'd come from Guyana. He was a deaf student in a school for the deaf where I was teaching, and he came without, he did not know English, he did not know sign language. He came actually without having had any access to language. And one thing was he was very, very, very isolated when he came, but also very angry about it, too, and who wouldn't be? But when he came into our school, the idea for me was, how can I reach him? How can we give Wayne a source of community? And I really, I think everything I've learned probably mostly from children, and he was one of my great teachers, because his falling in love with books was really through just watching. I tried to be very watchful to what his passions were, and he loved animals, he loved frogs, so we just like got every frog book we could possibly think of, and slowly but surely Wayne started to open books and be part of the community of the classroom. And the first day that he wrote something of his own, which was such a big achievement, he wrote the line, "I was the lonely deaf," to describe his experience growing up in Guyana. And, you know, to sit there together and realize, even for the kids in our class who also had grown up in struggling circumstances, that he was the only deaf student or child, or probably had never met other deaf people before he came to our school. It was really something. And I think those little books about frogs, and also just creating that environment, that caused me to create the acronym READ, R-E-A-D, for Ritual, Environment, Access, and Dialogue, that those were the things that broke it open for Wayne, that ritual every single day, no matter what, we were going to read together. The environment, that we were going to provide him with the kind of books that would help him to learn to love to read and not judge him for wanting to read every day about frogs and other animals. Access, for the fact that we wanted to give the books to him at his level, that even though he was 13, he really needed to read emerging books and nonfiction books is what he loved. He loved books with pictures in them. And then D for dialogue, that yes, you know, he didn't know really sign language and he didn't know English, but everybody has dialogue. Everybody has a way to communicate, and all of the kids in the class being so attentive to what might Wayne be thinking right now, I think is the thing that caused him to be able to write, "I was the lonely deaf," on the page.
Well, see, the thing is, you make it seem so simple, but I think for a lot of parents out there, it's not that simple, so... Again, you know, really invaluable.
Oh, thanks so much. I know it's a hard, it sure is hard, especially with when you have kids who really do have reading struggles. I think it's hard to be objective, and, you know, when it's your own child, you love them so much, you know, you really just want them to be okay and not to struggle. And I do say to parents, you know, the struggle is part of what it means to be a reader. I mean, I said that to Wayne all the time. You know, I struggle too as a reader. Everybody does. Because I think children think they're the only ones. They think you look like the perfect reader. You don't have any trouble. And I think it's really important for our children to know that we struggle too, and that we still find this incredible, you know, that there's jewels inside books, and it's worth the struggle.
Now, the 50 themes... wanting to have a section that was organized that way, how did you come up with that idea?
Well, that was also, again, another aspect of just watching and observing and asking and thinking about a lot of the questions that kids have asked me over the years, and also just conversations and at home with our girls and their friends coming to our house, and also listening in classrooms to the kids talking and realizing there are definitely some common themes of childhood that our children are both experiencing with great joy and embracing, and some that they're really struggling with too, as we do as adults. And I thought, well, if I wrote down what were the most, you know, in my mind, the seminal themes, could we create some book lists to go with those themes so that parents have something to reach for, grandparents, caregivers have something to reach for when engaged in those conversations? And that's where the 50 themes, I tried to hope that they weren't so typical, that, you know, they're sort of the basics, but that we include the basics, but also a little bit serendipitous, a little bit of the kinds of quirky, funny things that kids are thinking about.
Well, I thought it was also a good model for parents to think about creating a reading list with their own kids based on what the child is experiencing developmentally and also what the child cares about. So one of the themes that I was very curious about was becoming someone who loves to write, and how so many educators really feel there's a corollary between a child who does read and if that reading impacts how well he or she writes. And I wondered if you would talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I see it as, you know, and maybe this, it's an image I use over and over for the work that I do with teachers, is that reading to me is like breathing in, and writing is like breathing out. You know, you're ingesting words and words and words, and then the writing is the manifestation of all of that you've been breathing all of that time. And so I think they're inextricably linked. I actually think they're so detached in school to some degree that I'm constantly saying, you know, I'm constantly speaking to that subject. You've got to bring them together so that our kids see that they're so deeply connected. And there's some really beautiful children's books about the love of writing and just the love of words. Some really, really cute ones like Ronnie Schotter's The Boy Who Loved Words, and a little boy who's just collecting them and writing them down everywhere and stuffing new ones down his socks and up his sleeves. And so that's, you know, that child who also just loves words, and to model that for our children from such a young age, as well as a beautiful, beautiful collection by edited by Paul Genesco, one of the great poetry collectors of all time, you know, called The Place My Words Are Looking For, and where poets talk about why words mean so much to them.
Well, I thought by making this one of the 50 themes, it was a good way of bringing some attention to that, because I'm not sure that everybody thinks of it that way, and that was I think,
that's
definitely
nice.
A step in the right direction.
Oh, good.
So I heard that you are writing two more books now.
Yeah.
What are you working on?
Now, so, well, I have one coming along that's called Books for Boys, which, based on our earlier part of this conversation, I think will be of interest. And I want to get some feedback from you, too, on what you're thinking, too, because we've been doing a lot of research about this and thinking about it, and I think we've put together quite a nice collection. But, you know, it's still, the gender issue is really loaded, so it's a good conversation, and I'm glad to have it. As I'm writing, I'm thinking a lot about that. So that's one. And then the second one is kind of a follow-up to What to Read When. Avery Penguin is publishing it. It's called A Child's Writing Life. And it's actually just in the spirit of this idea that reading and writing are so inextricably linked. I want to talk with families and teachers about how we can, from the very beginning, nurture the capacity in the child to write. Because look at, I mean, the world is full. The technology now is making it possible for us to be writing constantly all the time. And so I want our children to grow up feeling really empowered that way.
So actually, you're writing two books.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Yeah, I am.
So, do you have time to read?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Always. Oh, my gosh, I can't stop myself. I'm kind of compulsive.
So, do you set aside time every day, or you're just doing it?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say that. I ad hoc. I mean, do you set aside time, or do you kind of just grab it where you can?
Well, I have to set aside time to read manuscripts. So.
Yeah, you do. You're lucky to be. It must be so much fun to read.
It's part of the job.
Yeah.
But not on the job. So you were traveling this summer, and you were meeting with students and their educators, and did you meet some parents too?
Yes. Well, I worked with a school. We worked with several schools in Kenya, and then several other schools in Liberia. In fact, the schools in Liberia are run by another Amherst grad by the name of Kimmy Weeks. And he invited me there to help work with his teachers on behalf of our organization, Lit World. And I'm so grateful to you, Phoebe, and for other Amherst grads who've been so helpful in the support of this organization to bring literacy methods to schools all across the world. At the school in Kenya, the children are mostly HIV/AIDS orphans, and a lot of the teachers in the school are actually also raising the children. So they serve both as parents and teachers for the children. But it was a wonderful summer, and we were able to work with a lot of teachers and meet a lot of the children who love books.
And do you want to share a reading or writing experience that came out of that trip? Did the kids write their own stories, or was there a story that you wanted to share with them?
Yes, we did bring books in our suitcase. We didn't pack too many clothes. We packed mostly books, and we gave out a lot of children's books, and the children just absolutely loved them, and so did the teachers. They loved the pictures, and they loved the stories. I would say one of the most striking moments for me was at Red Rose School in Kibera in Kenya, the school for HIV/AIDS orphans. There was a moment where I was in a classroom and I was telling them a story. I was reading aloud to them from a book about a woman who was collecting fruit in a basket. And it was a very simple story. I think it's called Honda's Basket. I can't remember the author, but a beautiful little book. And she was collecting this fruit, and so I asked the children to tell a story also, like kind of off the story of the book that we had read. And they started to tell about all the different kinds of fruits that they would collect and then how they would travel in the woods and give out the fruits to the animals that they meant, the elephants and the giraffes. And afterwards, one of the children came and put her hand in mine, and she said to me, "I just love that story, Mrs. Allen." And I said, "Yeah, the one you guys made." And she said, "Yeah, the one we made." And I said, "How come?" And she said, "I just loved it because sometimes I'm so hungry, and that story made me feel a lot better." And I just thought, okay, you know, literature and storytelling and narrative, I mean, if it can get a child past the hump of hunger for just a minute, I want to help her. You know, I want to put food in her stomach. But it, at least also, if the words can soothe her for the time being, until we can fix all these problems, I hope we can do better for them, because there are so many hungry children, and they're not just hungry for food; they're also hungry for learning, and they need both.
Now, in your book, you give a gift of a book to family members, to colleagues. If you could give a children's book to the Amherst community, is there one that you would want to share?
Ah, that's such a great question, Phoebe. You always have such insight. I did love that part for myself because it was so much fun to give people these, like, imaginary, you know, books in my dedication or my acknowledgments. I loved doing that. I guess for Amherst, oh my, I love Amherst. I could give Amherst all my
books.
There
are many, many books.
But I'll tell you what, here's the book I'd give Amherst. This is the perfect book for Amherst. I'd give Amherst Harold and the Purple Crayon.
Because?
And I'll tell you why. First, because all Harold has is the crayon, and it's a genius of a book. You know, he leaves his house, he lives where he lives, and he's in his little PJs, and he goes out into the world with just this crayon, and he creates a world. And I think in so many ways, just watching our daughter at Amherst now and thinking about my own experience there and talking with you and other dear friends about the experience, I think there is something about that that Amherst gives these very simple tools that you don't, it's not so complicated that, you know, if you have a way to think critically and a way to fall in love with something and a way to be yourself in the world, the simplest tool, a crayon, can create worlds. And I think that's really what this great education does for people. And the stories that people have told me, from Kimmy Weeks in Liberia to my daughter who's there now, who say, you know, I just being here makes me think differently. And I think that, you know, Harold going out into the world with that crayon. And one more thought, of course, being that it is purple, of course. And so we can't deny.
There you go. And Crockett Johnson didn't even go to Amherst.
Well, we won't hold that against him. But it is true that that I think Amherst does still to this day teach me those lessons, and I'm so grateful for it.
Well, you know what? I think everyone should go and get a copy of Harold and the Purple Crayon and go get a copy of What to Read When, because that was the other thing I was thinking, too, that if you are a caregiver, it makes perfect sense to read What to Read When, but it even if you don't work with children or you don't have children, it's just a great book to read it. And sort of remember sort of your favorite children's books, or as I found when I took this my children's literature course with Jane Yolen over at Smith, that was what made me want to go into children's publishing. And what was very empowering for me was finding out about children's book authors that I did not know about at all.
Wow.
And so I would say your gift to the Amherst community is to really go and find these children's books that, you know, some of them you know and some of them you should get to know.
Thank you.
So, Pam, thank you for spending this time
chatting
with me.
Thank you. You're glad you took that class with Jane Yolen. You've changed the world of children's publishing with the books that you've put out into the world for us to share with parents and teachers and grandparents. And so, boy, oh boy, am I grateful for that. And thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Have a good day.
And you too.